You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a sociologist explains why women do most of the cognitive household labor. That's things like buying more toilet paper before you run out and remembering to send your nieces and nephews birthday gifts. Now, we're talking about the latest COVID news, including Milwaukee lifting its mask mandate, vaccination rates, new naming conventions for COVID variants, and more. You are part of this conversation. Call now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? Now that masks aren't required in most places, will you continue to wear yours even if you're vaccinated? Does it worry you that the U.S. probably won't reach herd immunity? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ajay Sethi is an associate professor of population health sciences and director of the Master of Public Health program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's an infectious disease epidemiologist. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Keely.
We know the city of Milwaukee's mask mandate ends today. Really following the rest of Wisconsin and most of the states in the country, where is Wisconsin in terms of vaccination and case numbers? Because the CDC guidance tells us that people who are vaccinated are no longer necessarily wearing masks.
Yeah, a lot of people in Wisconsin have been vaccinated or have chosen to do so. We still have work to do, but a lot of people have been vaccinated and case rates have been coming down, and we're at levels really that are sort of at the very early parts of our pandemic with our 7-day average of below 200 now.
Help us understand, what does that mean and what can that tell us about the safety of shedding those masks at this point?
Well, people who are unvaccinated should continue to wear masks because the virus is still circulating and the rates in unvaccinated individuals is very high. The reason why we're doing well as a state is because so many people have chosen vaccination and we're seeing less spread. But as long as unvaccinated people gather with each other and somebody may be infected, we have a chance of continued outbreaks.
One of the milestones we've reached this month is that COVID hospitalizations are the lowest in Wisconsin that they've ever been since the state started tracking that in April of last year. What can that tell us about how the virus is spreading or how it's affecting people?
Yeah, so the hospitalization data is really good news. Ever since the beginning of this pandemic, preserving our healthcare systems and making sure the most vulnerable in our society are not, you know, coming down with severe COVID and maybe even worse outcomes than that has been really important. And when we look at vaccination rates across the state, we see trends by age indicating that people who see themselves as vulnerable for severe COVID have chosen vaccination. And people in younger ages too, because they understand that they're part of the chain of transmission. For that reason, hospitalizations come down. We've also know that mitigation is continuing. Even though mask mandates are being lifted and precautions are being relaxed, a lot of people still, you know, aren't attending gatherings, still wear their masks when they need to, and keep their distance as indicated. All of that contributes to cases coming down. And when hospitalizations come down, that's great news.
And the CDC, even in saying that vaccinated adults don't have to wear masks all the time, they did say you should continue to wear masks in certain circumstances, and that includes hospitals and schools.
That's right. I mean, in hospitals in general, we should always be cautious because hospitals can often be the source of different infectious agents. So wearing a mask in those settings is a good idea. In schools, especially where kids are not even eligible to be vaccinated, we should really still be wearing masks in order to keep transmission down. And also for travel, it's important that people wear masks during travel, and the airlines are certainly requiring it.
And why is it important in travel, but not, say, necessarily at your local grocery store?
Yeah, I mean, so businesses are deciding whether or not they want to maintain a mask mandate. And so some of the reasons are for that reason alone. Some grocery stores may still be requiring masks. But certainly when you're thinking about a local grocery store, the local epidemiology and the case rates will decide whether people feel like a mask mandate is necessary. And obviously they're being relaxed. When it comes to travel, this is the way most infections spread around the country, within the country, around the world. And because of variants that are around the world, we do want to make sure that we're not unnecessarily stirring the pot, because we know that COVID is still quite epidemic in many parts of the country, or some counties in the country and parts of the world.
We're talking about what we know and what we don't know about this stage of the global health crisis. Our guest is UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi. You can join this conversation, ask your question at 1-800-642-1234. What are you wondering about the state of the pandemic? Now that kids 12 and older are eligible for vaccination, will your children be getting the COVID vaccine? Maybe you've opted out of vaccination right now. Are you still wearing your mask? And how are you helping to pull us out of this pandemic? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ajay, 16 states, including Wisconsin, have vaccinated their incarcerated population at higher rates than their general population. That's from the COVID Prison Project, and that's based on the 27 states that reported their data. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, congregate living facilities everywhere, you know, have been the sites of major outbreaks for COVID, and where many cases have occurred, hospitalizations and deaths. And prisons are included in that. So I would hope that those populations are receiving the vaccine at higher rates, because the epidemic has been so concentrated in facilities like that, places like that, nursing homes as well. And that's why we would also want to see very high rates of vaccine uptake in anybody and living in a nursing home or any congregate living facility.
Well, speaking of vaccinations, because children age 12 and up are now eligible to get COVID vaccines, how much of an effect could that have on the spread of the virus?
Greatly. Right now, people who are unvaccinated are just not representative of people who are vaccinated, particularly by age. Now that the eligibility has come down to 12, that helps a lot. In the fall, when children as young as 2 are eligible for the vaccine, that's going to help even more. As the more people who get vaccinated, the better it is for reducing transmission in all of our communities. Of course, children have to become vaccinated, and that's the decision of parents talking to their children about getting vaccinated, and hopefully more will choose to do so.
Well, that brings us to this concept of herd immunity. I mean, last month we heard experts say herd immunity against COVID-19 is not going to be possible in the U.S. with this addition that, like, that might be okay. Will you put that into context for us? What are we talking about now when it comes to herd immunity?
Yeah, so when we think about herd immunity, we're talking about a state in our society where we don't see widespread outbreaks or really any outbreaks at all. That's something that's in the distant future. Between now and then, we can certainly begin to return to normal and feel safer the lower our case rates are, which is going to be a direct result of more people choosing vaccination. We're seeing that now, and we still have progress to make, and that can be done. When we have very few cases being transmitted and case rates are very low, we can just feel as a society that we're in a better place. We may not be able to call that herd immunity because the virus continues to transmit, but we can achieve a milestone of exceptional control in Wisconsin, which is still very important.
What about the messaging when it comes to vaccination? Because we, in the beginning, heard a lot of conversation about how immunization isn't just about you. Yes, it protects you, but this is about your community. And if we don't feel like we're going to get a full grip on this, and we're still going to see COVID-19 around, how do we encourage people to follow the science and get vaccines when it seems more selfish?
Well, I mean, people have to choose vaccination. People deserve their autonomy in making that decision. Of course, there's a conversation about mandated vaccines, and that's also something that may come up. It certainly comes up in certain settings, some college campuses, maybe some workplaces will choose to do that. But for right now, the decision to get the vaccine is an individual one, largely. And if people see the vaccine as something that can give them a lot of confidence that they can avoid some of the worst outcomes of COVID, hopefully they can choose to get vaccinated. There are delays in when how long it takes for someone to make that decision, and that's okay. We don't expect everybody to be on board in, very quickly, but over time, hopefully we can chip away at that, and more people will choose to get the vaccine.
We're talking with Ajay Sethi, who stays with us. He's an associate professor of population health sciences, and he's the director of the Master of Public Health program at the UW-Madison. We're talking all things COVID-19, and there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know from an epidemiologist about the future of the pandemic, variants of the coronavirus, or vaccinations? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. From herd immunity to vaccine hesitancy to inoculation rates and mask mandates, this conversation is rooted in what you need to know right now in this pandemic. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi. We're looking at the latest COVID news, and we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. We've got Marcus in Madison ready to join this conversation. Hi, Marcus.
Good afternoon, Professor Sethi. Perhaps you could tell me why I rarely hear anything about the current numbers from the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System of the CDC, which is government-funded. Just looking at it, it says that there are now 4,406 deaths and 21,537 adverse events, an increase of 205 deaths since last week, and over 3,000 increase since last week. I'm wondering why this is never brought up in these discussions.
Yeah, Marcus, thanks for that question. And I know we talk about adverse reactions as we discuss the vaccine, but also Marcus is throwing out lots of numbers, and I want to make sure that, Ajay, you're able to put those numbers into context for us and help us understand what that adverse events reporting system is.
Yeah, so that system is in place as sort of a catch-all for people who have been vaccinated to be able to report by themselves, for themselves, and through their providers anything that they may think could be related to the vaccine. It doesn't mean that it necessarily is related to the vaccine, but we won't know until we at least get some information or data. So the system's in place really as just sort of a broad way of collecting information. It then goes through a process in which it's vetted and examined for not even just quality of information, but to also see whether it's leading us to think that there could be an adverse event. It's an important system, but it's something that requires a lot, many more steps afterwards to determine validity of claims. And so we will hear something when something from the VAERS system alerts us to side effects that warrant, a public announcement. Until then, some of the rates of, for example, deaths may be very similar to the rate of death in people who are unvaccinated. So there isn't any cause for alarm. But the CDC certainly monitors that along with the FDA, and it's an important system.
So it's a reporting system. Those numbers are not necessarily linked to the virus. They're things that people that have come up in people's lives that they think may be linked to the vaccine?
Yeah, that's right. It's based on reporting from providers and sort of self-reports. It's not based on research or based on something that's systematic. It's really a catch-all system. But it's important because it can alert you to something that may be important for announcing a safety issue to the public. And there are processes in place. If something is not being announced, it's because there isn't anything to be concerned about at the moment.
Well, we saw some of that with the pause in the Johnson & Johnson or the Janssen COVID-19 vaccine when we saw some adverse reactions come up. They paused it so that they could work through the science, and then the science validated that the J&J vaccine was safe. Is that how it's supposed to work?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so when there is reason for concern, a pause may be required to get more information, as well as it be an opportunity to talk to providers across the country to alert them of something like blood clots that came up with the J&J vaccine. And after a systematic review, in that case, the vaccine, using the vaccine again, you know, it was resumed because it didn't warrant taking that vaccine off the market. So the system, it's a good system, but it's often sort of overinterpreted, and it's better to let the FDA and the CDC experts decide what deserves our attention.
Marcus, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Ajay Sethi, who's a UW-Madison epidemiologist. We're getting the latest on crucial information to have at this stage of the coronavirus pandemic, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Anne is in Door County and wants to join the conversation. Good afternoon, Anne.
Hi, this is Anne. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering. I'm fully vaccinated. I am 65, and I am to have overnight weekend, extended weekend guests who are not vaccinated. And I'm wondering about the precautions or wisdom of having people in my home, especially as I am also dealing with and taking care of my 91-year-old parents frequently. That's my question.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing this up, because as some people choose not to get the vaccine, families are in this situation, or friends are in this situation of having to figure out what's safe and what isn't. Ajay, what are the risks here?
I mean, so I don't know if Anne's 91-year-old parents are vaccinated. I'm going to presume that they are. Anybody who is vaccinated can feel very confident that they're not going to have severe COVID if they were to become infected. And the likelihood of becoming infected is also very low. And if they were infected, it's not likely that they're going to transmit to others. The guests who are unvaccinated, since they're few in number, if it's 100 people visiting your house, all unvaccinated, I'd be concerned. If it's a few people, I would be less concerned, especially if community rates for COVID are very low. You can always ask guests to seek a COVID test before coming to your home if that made you comfortable. You can always ask guests to wear a mask if that made you feel comfortable as well. And just have that conversation about how best to lower risk for everybody. But right now, the gathering of people who are vaccinated and unvaccinated can be done safely simply because community transmission is on the low end.
Anne talked about her parents in her 90s. The flip side to that is that children under 12 cannot be vaccinated. So what if she were in the position of having children who were unable to be vaccinated around people who are not vaccinated? Would your recommendation change at all?
Yeah, I mean, in general, when you have a lot of people who are unvaccinated together, you'd be concerned about any spread from person to person among those people who are unvaccinated. The fewer, the better. Gathering is also important for our mental health. That's something we haven't been doing a lot of in 2020, and to be able to do that now is important. But you got to think about the safety and just make sure that if we can test people, it's nice to do that. They're still available, even though they're not in high demand today as they were months ago. I think those gatherings can still occur. And wearing masks is important when you're mixing people across multiple households that are unvaccinated.
I want to touch on another finding, and that's that COVID vaccinations are free in the United States. It's illegal to charge for them. And yet a Kaiser Family Foundation poll found a third of vaccinated adults aren't sure whether they need to pay for the shot or if insurance will cover it, or anything like that. I mean, what's behind the misunderstanding here, and what should public health officials do about it?
We have a healthcare system in the United States that's not very simple to navigate. And it stresses people out. It stresses me out every time I have to navigate the healthcare system. And sometimes you get surprise bills for things you didn't think you would. And all of that gets conflated with our government-funded public health campaign to vaccinate people, which is entirely free for everyone. But because health systems are part of the community of vaccinators, I think people get confused in thinking that they might get a bill when really they won't. And if they are, they shouldn't be. And that's just important that sort of anomalies should not be considered sort of the norm. Vaccine's free for everybody, and you shouldn't expect to be charged for it.
What else should people know right now that either we've heard a bit of and we're not talking about enough, or that's something new that we should be thinking about at this stage of the pandemic?
Well, at this stage, we should feel optimistic about our future. But we should recognize that there are a lot of people who are still unvaccinated. And I hope those individuals will choose to get vaccinated in the near future. You know, in the summer, we can enjoy some much needed sort of more relaxation and feeling like things are returning to normal. But come fall, as our activities move back indoor and respiratory viruses in general sort of increase in their spread, at those times, we should expect the same thing for COVID unless we can get more people vaccinated. And hopefully that'll be the case, but otherwise we can expect sort of a return to more spread in the fall months.
So you anticipate we'll see less this summer, but that we could absolutely see a rebound of coronavirus infections in the fall?
We certainly could if we don't have enough people vaccinated. There's a lot of time between now and then, and that's why we should encourage vaccination for anybody who hasn't chosen that already.
Ajay, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Keely.
Ajay Sethi is an associate professor of population health sciences, and he's director of the Master of Public Health program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We've been talking about what we need to know at this stage of the pandemic. Coming up, we talk to a researcher about the gender imbalance in the mental workload, sometimes called emotional labor or cognitive labor. She tells us about her findings on why this inequality persists. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. A USDA plan to provide billions in debt relief for Black and minority farmers is headed for the courts. Find out why with Jen White as she speaks to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. Plus, the movie club reviews Cruella. That's today on 1A Plus starting at 6 o'clock. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of Captain Frank Van Valkenburgh. The captain's remembrance was written by longtime Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Meg Jones. Meg passed away from cancer in December and spent much of her career covering Wisconsin veterans and service members.
Memorial Day is Monday, and today we're going to reflect on the life of one fallen soldier. Meg Jones tells us about the Milwaukee-born captain of the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor.
Franklin Van Valkenburgh spent his entire adult life training for war. And when that day came, Van Valkenburgh would be among the first to die. He grew up in Milwaukee, son of a prominent lawyer, and when he left for the U.S. Naval Academy in 1905, Van Valkenburgh never really came home again. He moved up through the ranks, serving on many vessels ranging from battleships to submarine tenders. In February 1941, Van Valkenburgh was assigned to what would turn out to be his last posting, the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. It was Van Valkenburgh's cruel fate to spend decades training for combat and die just 11 minutes into his first battle. It's true that America was caught by surprise when the Japanese attacked, but it's also true that the U.S. military was wary of Japanese aggression in the Pacific. That's why Navy commanders moved the Arizona and the rest of its fleet from the West Coast to Pearl Harbor. Like the other ship captains stationed at Pearl, Van Valkenburgh repeatedly trained his sailors and Marines for battle. In a letter to his aunt 1 month before the Japanese attack, he wrote about the long hours he spent on the Arizona's bridge putting his men through their paces. "We never go to sea," he wrote, "without being completely ready to move on to Singapore if need be. Our eyes are constantly trained westward, and we keep the guns ready for instant use against aircraft or submarines whenever we are at sea. We have no intention of being caught napping." That's just what happened, though. A Japanese attack not at sea, but while most of America's Navy was in port. The USS Arizona's band was on deck preparing to play the national anthem for the morning flag raising when the first torpedo bombers with rising sun emblems began to drop out of the sky. They swarmed like hornets over Battleship Row, dropping torpedoes that streaked through the water, blowing holes in ships where sailors were sleeping, eating breakfast, and getting ready for shore leave.
"We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air."
When the Arizona's air raid alarm sounded at 7:55 a.m., Van Valkenburgh was seen sprinting to the one place a ship's captain needed to be, the bridge. As he emerged from the conning tower, Van Valkenburgh was hit by shrapnel that tore into his abdomen. He must have been in intense pain, but he refused to be carried to safety. Instead, he stayed at his post, directing the defense of his ship. Torpedoes rocked the Arizona, but the death blow came from a bomb that penetrated the deck and ignited the ship's forward ammunition compartment. Witnesses said it looked as if the Arizona leaped out of the water. A grainy color film shows a bolt of flame and black smoke blowing sky high as the ship exploded. It would become the iconic image of America's first minutes of World War II. It was 8:06 a.m. Van Valkenburgh's body was never found. Only his Naval Academy class ring and two uniform buttons were recovered. He was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor, and to this day, he's officially listed as missing in action. His name is on the large white wall at the USS Arizona Memorial, along with the 1,176 men under his command who died at Pearl Harbor. Perhaps most fitting for a man who spent his entire life in service, his name is not at the top of the list of Arizona casualties. It's actually toward the bottom because the list is alphabetical. I think Franklin Van Valkenburgh would have wanted it that way.
Meg Jones is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and author of the book World War II Milwaukee. She brought us the story of Captain Franklin Van Valkenburgh. He was one of 56 Wisconsinites to die at the attack at Pearl Harbor. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. We're going to get this next segment started with a tweet. On March 22nd, 2019, a Twitter user named Robin Beth Scher tweeted, "My friend and her husband lived in an apartment that had a soap dispenser installed on the edge of the kitchen sink. When they moved out after 2 years, he marveled to her, 'It's amazing how that dispenser never ran out of soap in all this time.' Women's work is truly invisible." Robin followed up that tweet with the end to the story, writing, "She never told him the truth. He still thinks wistfully of that amazing, magical soap dispenser they once had." This story got more than 100,000 likes on Twitter, and hundreds of people replied, sharing their own experiences. There's a name for this kind of thing: realizing that the soap dispenser needs to be filled, or remembering relatives' birthdays, or knowing that you have to find the right summer camp for your kid months in advance. It's called cognitive labor, and research shows that women in heterosexual partnerships do most of it. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this kind of thing in your relationship? Have you and your partner found a way to make the mental workload equal? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Allison Dominger is a doctoral student in sociology and social policy at Harvard University. Her work focuses on how societal inequities affect family dynamics. Her paper, The Cognitive Dimension of Household Labor, breaks down the gender gap in cognitive labor. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. What is the definition of cognitive labor? How do you explain it to people?
The way that I think about it is having four components that unfold over time in a process. The first is anticipation. The second is identification, then decision making, and then monitoring. And just to give you an example of how those break down, anticipation would be something like recognizing that we're running low on soap, as in the example that you cited, or that we need to have dinner tonight and don't yet have a plan. Then you need to identify some options for meeting whatever need you've anticipated. Like, I could order some more soap from Amazon, or I could unfreeze the lasagna that I put in the freezer last month. Next is making a decision or choosing among the options you've identified. So I'm going to stop by Target on my way home from work, or I'm going to call in a pizza order. And then finally is monitoring. That's the follow-up work of making sure that whatever you decided on was executed successfully and met your need. So did the Target I stopped by have the soap I wanted, or do I need to stop by somewhere else? Did my spouse remember to put in the pizza order in time? Things like that.
And you have found that these different tasks, some of them are actually generally shared between heterosexual couples, but then some of those four elements that you just described fall more toward women.
Exactly. So I looked at those four components and I found that in most cases, decision-making was shared between members of the different sex couples that I interviewed. So not necessarily at the level of what's for dinner, but if it were something with financial implications or longer term consequences, most of the time couples would decide together. Now, the pre-work of getting to that decision stage was often more gender unequal. So for instance, the work of noticing, anticipating, remembering, monitoring, that all tended to be much more female dominated. So women are more likely to remember that a birthday is upcoming. They're more likely to, notice that they're running low on a food item, that it's time to register for summer camp, etc.
We've got John from Madison on the line who's ready to join our conversation. Welcome to the Ideas Network, John.
Hi. I was calling to just say that my wife definitely does do the majority of the cognitive labor in our relationship. But we guys, we can help, and we do these things with like yard work, or if we need some kind of maintenance done for a system in our house or something like that. We're doing a lot of that stuff too, and I just wonder if those bigger things that they have a lot of like huge consequences if you don't maintain your systems in your home. Those can weigh heavily on guys too.
Yeah, John, thanks for bringing that up and talking about the fact that Allison, your research doesn't show that men don't have any level of mental load. It just appears that women carry more of the burden. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to John's point, I found that the work of, maintaining the home and the lawn and sometimes the long-term finances were the two areas that were the least female-dominated on the cognitive dimension. So as John pointed out, men are often realizing, oh, it's time to replace this part on the lawnmower and things like that. I did, however, find that, a lot of that work is at least somewhat, discretionary, right? You can save it for the weekend or for a convenient time, whereas a lot of the everyday stuff of making sure food's on the table and the kids are dressed and the clothes that they need, that tended to be more female-dominated.
You asked the couples you talked to explain why they think there's this imbalance in the mental workload. What did they tell you?
Over and over again, I heard that it's about our personalities. Mm. So they would say something like, she's type A and really organized, and he's laid back and relaxed. And that's why, she manages the calendar, she is on top of vacation planning, and he does whatever she delegates to him. And I didn't find this credible for a couple of reasons. So first, a lot of these men had day jobs that required high degree of organization, whether, being surgeons or project managers or things like that. So it seemed more like it was something about the context. And further, we know from broader studies about gender and personality that in terms of, things like organization, men and women on average are not all that different.
And so these couples are interpreting what's going on in one way, but when you look at it scientifically, you're saying there's a bit of a disconnect here, and that might be more related to our expectations of different genders?
I think it's a complicated set of factors. So our expectations of men and women, for instance, is huge, right? So mothers in our society, for better or worse, are often held accountable when things go wrong with the children or the family. And that gives them extra incentive to be organized and be on top of things so that they're not letting things slip through the cracks. And then there's also, you know, childhood socialization, the way that we raise our girls and our boys to, you know, be neat and quiet or messy and loud. All of those things play a role in shaping our sense of self and ultimately the roles we play in our romantic relationships.
We're talking with Allison Dominger, who's a doctoral student in sociology and social policy at Harvard University. And we are talking about the idea of mental load and why it falls primarily to women when you look at heterosexual relationships. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you experience this in your own relationship or have you seen it in other people's? Maybe you've had trouble even explaining what tasks are included in the mental workload to try to explain why you're spending so much time and energy on things your spouse might not fully understand. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking with Allison Dominger. She's a sociologist studying how social inequalities affect family dynamics, including an unequal division of labor between heterosexual partners. We want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you feel that you take on the mental workload? How have you effectively explained it to your partner? Or do you think it's always been this way, so it's just going to be this way for yourself? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Allison, research has established that married women do more housework than their male partners. A 2019 study found that women married to men spend more time on housework than single moms do. A 2011 Pew study found that women do twice as much childcare as their male partners and spend 8 hours more per week on household chores. Does this inequality in physical housework also play a role in the cognitive labor gap?
That's a really great question, Keeley. I think partly yes. So for one, the cognitive and physical work in the house is often intertwined. If you are deciding what to make for dinner, it's often easiest for you to then actually chop the vegetables or go shopping. So because there's this close entanglement between physical and cognitive labor, the partner who's doing more of the physical chores like cooking and cleaning and shopping is often also the one who's doing more of the cognitive labor. The other issue that I'd mention, though, is that I think increasingly many of us are recognizing that housework and childcare should be, ideally we'd like them to be, shared equally. And the mental load or cognitive labor is not quite as often talked about, which means that when couples are working on, you know, dividing up tasks and trying to reach equity in their relationship, this often falls through the cracks. And so what I often see is couples who have done a pretty good job of living up to their own ideals on the physical labor front. They share the cooking and cleaning pretty equitably. But then on the cognitive labor front, they're much more traditional because it's not something that they've discussed or really thought about as a core part of running their household and raising their children.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what about this concept that some men have admitted to? They say, well, if you tell me what to do, I can do it. I mean, that is putting the mental load on your female partner, right?
Exactly. So one study calls this the manager-helper dynamic, right? Where implicitly you're saying, by asking your wife or your female partner to tell you what to do, you're suggesting that it's ultimately her responsibility. She's in charge. She's responsible for figuring out what needs doing. And that is not really a partnership model. It's more of a, you know, manager helper or supervisor supervisee relationship, which may work for some people, but for many of us, that's not necessarily our ideal in a romantic partnership.
We're talking with Allison Dominger, who's a doctoral student at Harvard University, and her work focuses on how societal inequalities affect family dynamics. And we're discussing the role of mental work in our relationships and how it feeds into how we take care of our families. And we've got Cynthia in Richland Center ready to talk with us. Hey, Cynthia.
Good afternoon. I guess my only comment is I don't think it is always the way you're saying it is, that it falls to the female. I'm a former kindergarten and four-year-old kindergarten teacher, and I've seen child care rearing really fall on the back burner, that for nobody was doing it, and nobody was doing a really good job of it. And what I see in my own family, my one son that has two children, he does all the cooking, and he does the drop-off and pick-up of the children at daycare, and he's with them at night until they go to bed while his wife is working. So it isn't always the female that's doing the mental lifting.
Cynthia, thanks for that point. And Allison, we can circle back to the idea that this is overall what we're seeing, and certainly there are exceptions here.
Exactly. So Cynthia is correct to point out that this dynamic that I've described does not by any means apply to every family. However, the families that I've studied, who are mostly college educated, heterosexually partnered with young children, the vast majority, so about 85%, were female-led for cognitive labor. And that leaves the 15% who are doing something different, whether that's sharing it equally or putting more on the male partner's plate. And in ongoing work, I'm looking more closely at those non-traditional couples and trying to see what sets them apart from the mainstream.
And even if you decide and make good on that in a heterosexual relationship and you share the mental workload, that doesn't mean everybody else will respect that. I will just tell you that I think all of our children's teachers have meant well. And there are times that I am the only one that gets an email, and not my husband, when it's certainly something that, you know, requires one of our attention, and he might be more available than I am that day. So certainly sometimes things are just directed at the women in the family that men aren't in the loop on.
Exactly. There's often, we're embedded in these broader structures, right? We don't get to just decide everything in our own nuclear family and then, you know, get the rest of the world to sort of fall in line. As you point out, I hear from many of my non-traditional respondents that they get pushback from, you know, parents or in-laws who are confused about why he's doing it instead of her. Or they get the emails or the phone calls when the child is sick and needs to be picked up from school, right? Rather than starting with the father, if they put that preference first, they call the mom because that's just what usually happens. So even if you are trying really hard in your own relationship to pursue this equity, it's likely that there will be some bumps in the road and external obstacles.
If people listening right now go, you know what, I feel this deeply, what is an initial step that they can take, recognizing that everyone's relationship is different?
The first thing I usually recommend to people is to sit down with your spouse or your partner and talk about what it is that each of you are doing. I think you can't reallocate or change things until you're both clear on what work, cognitive, emotional, physical, goes into maintaining your household and your family. And in the process of figuring out what work is involved and who is doing what, you may see some imbalances. And if that is not in line with the way that you'd like to be in your relationship, then you can start thinking about, okay, what is one thing that I am doing that my partner might be able to take over? And it's important here not to just think about individual tasks, like dropping the kids off at soccer practice, but to think about everything that's involved in getting to that point. So that might be things like registering for the soccer league. That might be things like making sure that the uniform is cleaned and that snacks have been prepared. So being very specific about exactly what is entailed in that one small task can really help with getting you to a more equitable place.
Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Allison Dominger is a doctoral student in sociology and social policy at Harvard University. Her work focuses on how societal inequalities affect family dynamics. You're listening to Central Time, and it's here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then, summer months can be a time when worker productivity decreases. We talked to a writer who says we should embrace the slowdown and stop to take a break. I'm Keeley Pultina. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.